Will the Judiciary Committee please come to order? Present, we have Senator Rhodey, Senator Frank, and we are consider first House Bill 156 by Representative Brown. She is in session. I think the staff went to go get her. I don't know whether I'm going to call, but the question we left this legislation with was the reasons for the differences between the immunity provided in this bill versus immunity provided in other similar legislation for psychologists and professionals in that area. We're going to hear from the Department of Law. We've got Dean Vannelli. I'd kind of like to know what public safety has got to say. She flinched. Well, let's start out with how we have it signed up. Cindy?
Yeah.
Sure. That's nice.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Please join us.
For the record, my name is Cindy Smith. I'm the Executive Director of the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. The network is a coalition of 22 nonprofit programs that serve victims and their families. But we've had an opportunity to review the proposed amendment to the bill. The network would oppose that amendment fairly strongly. In fact, we would consider it to be of such negative impact to the bill that we could no longer support it. Briefly, the amendment is made on the basis, according to the memo, that it somehow grants a broader privilege to victims of crime rather than in comparison to, say, for instance, the physicians and psychotherapists. I wouldn't gauge that as an accurate description. Again, the privilege is not broader, it is different. And what that means is that while there are areas in which there are exceptions made in the physicians and psychotherapist privilege that are not in this privilege, there are exceptions in this privilege which are not in the physicians and psychotherapist privilege. So the point is that although this particular amendment addresses an area that isn't the physicians and psychotherapist privilege and is not in ours, it does not mean we have better privilege or more privilege. It's just different. You will note that we have a series of 8 or 9 exceptions in our bill that are not, some of which, majority of which, are not in physicians and psychotherapist privilege. The language in physicians and psychotherapist privilege are there for a reason. First of all, physicians and psychotherapists make diagnoses. They are professionals who make diagnoses of internal conditions. In other words, no one else can really speak to a problem if you have cancer or if you have a mental illness except your physician or your psychotherapist. They are qualified professionals who perform that function and no one else can do it. They are also dealing in matters which qualified professional judgment is essential to fair resolution. Again, because they're the only people who can speak to whether somebody is mentally ill or has cancer or whatever. They are the people, only people who can do that. Neither of these circumstances are the case with victims of violent crime. Victims of violent crime have something that had happened to them in an external fashion. It can be proven by any number of measures, including police reports, medical reports, testimony of friends and neighbors and so on and so on. We are not the only or even the major provider in terms of what has happened to them, nor is it an internal matter which we are alone or qualified to diagnose. That's simply not the case. We do not diagnose, we do not treat, and our records are not investigative, which means that we don't swear them in at the door. We do not concern ourselves with issues of fact. We are not there to record that at 10:15 on such and such a night, XYZ happened. That is not the nature of our records and is therefore not going to be, I believe, a primary use in courts anyway. The assumption is being made here that the appropriate comparison is to physicians and psychotherapists, or more specifically to psychologists. I would submit to you that the appropriate comparison is to other victim laws in other states. There are 23 states that have victim legislation. Over 10 of those have no exceptions at all. And only two that I was able to find had this particular one. So the great majority of the cases, this has not been inserted into the laws in other states, and we believe for good reason. The reason that we believe is that this will affect, if it goes into the law, would have the effect of breaching confidentiality in areas from child custody to survivors of child sexual assault who are suing their perpetrator, to battered women, self-defense. These are the people like that who are the most victimized of our victims.
A question. Mm-hmm. You're saying that the bill, if amended in that way, is worse than the existing law?
There is no existing law, and what I mean by that specifically is that each judge right now is interpreting it in different ways. So that our experience, and I did poll the programs that I was able to reach, which were the majority of programs.
Excuse me, is the House under a call?
Yes.
Thank you for your work on the bill.
Is that in most cases right now, these records are not being brought in, and that judges are, in fact, making determinations that it's not appropriate. Not all judges are doing that, and not in every case. So that this is, in fact, presenting a statutory guide that says, yes, it is appropriate for you to do that, and we believe that it's not. The fact is, if a victim makes a claim or a defense, as it stands now, they still have to prove that. But there's nothing in law that says, which is why we have privileges at all, that every possible scrap of any potentially relevant information has to be available at trial. If that were true, we'd have no privileges for clergy or for attorneys or for anyone else. It's always a judgment call that's being made. In our case, we believe that because victims of crimes have something that's happened to them externally, because there are lots of other records and lots of other ways that they can prove that has occurred, that going into records like counseling records that have deeply personal things in them is inappropriate and will lead to a chilling effect in terms of victims being willing to pursue civil suits and even using our services at all. So, yeah, we do believe it's worse.
Questions by members of the committee? Senator Rody.
Just a comment. I think the primary the problem that some of the critics have had is the some of the rather lengthy drafting of the bill that probably has been avoided with the, because you're really not setting forth anything that is neither new or unusual. You're providing for there may be the counselor may not be compelled, and then you're providing for the waiver of privilege. And as I look at it, there's a lot of extraneous language that could be tied up with and maintain the same thing. I think that whoever did the drafting ran on was much fonder of Faulkner than they were of Hemingway. And then things like, for example, the change that might be made on under definitions of victim counseling center. This would broaden it. I would just insert instead of saying private organization or a local government agency, I'd just say a private or governmental agency. That would ensure that there is no loophole in the event that the state or the federal government provides counseling in this area. I would recommend that as a answer. I presume you wouldn't disagree with that.
I have no problem with it.
And the with regard to the looking at Section 3, it might be possible, for example, to point out on lines 18 through sub C 17 through 22, you could simply provide the language there. You could say, victim counselor may not be compelled to provide any testimony in civil, criminal, or administrative proceedings, comma, and then drop the middle language, unless the court or hearing officer determines the information is necessary and relevant to the facts of the case. That would actually provide you more protection with less verbiage and be right to the point and would allow the trier of fact to make that determination in those events when it might be appropriate. So those are, if I were to make suggestions, those would be the kind that I would make, and I suspect you would probably agree with them. The two suggestions of topping the bill rather than watered it down, which I know is your concern on behalf of Alaska's victims of abuse.
That's correct, and certainly since we are not attorneys, we are at the mercy of drafters, so I'm...
A terrible position to be in.
We're happy to consider those kinds of changes. But yes, in summary, our concern is that the net effect of the amendments being produced is that it will actually statutorily weaken the position which we have tenuously, but still have at present, and that we don't believe it's fundamentally fair for a woman who has been beaten repeatedly by a spouse to come into a custody hearing and suddenly find her counseling records being subpoenaed. We don't think that's reasonable. We've already made a provision so that if it's a question of a child in need of aid or a child victim of abuse, that those exceptions exist. But in terms of the kinds of laws that we spent a lot of time working on in this legislature over the past few years, in terms of civil suits for child sexual abuse victims, in terms of having judges consider domestic violence when awarding custody, we believe that the changes would have an extremely negative effect in terms of victims being willing to bring it up at all, and ultimately willing to come to us for services. So we have tried and devotedly worked with departments in trying to draft this legislation. We've made exceptions wherever we felt we could do that. So I would really just say that to this committee that I hope that you vote against this amendment. I believe that it's not necessary. I think that if it occurs, it makes the bill worse than no bill.
Further questions? I've got a question just while you're here before we go to the next person. There's a section in the bill that deals with inference from claim of privilege. And it essentially says, and there's some interesting language in it, but it says a claim of privilege under this section, whether in a present proceeding or on a prior occasion, is not a proper subject to comment by a judge, hearing officer, legislator, or counsel. And I'm kind of interested that we're telling ourselves that this is not something that we should consider in the future or something. It's just odd. I've never seen us say to ourselves as legislators that this is not a proper subject to comments. I'm curious about that.
Mr. Statement. Chairman, this was a section of language that was introduced in past judiciary. I think the intent, whether it's accomplished or not, is maybe quite another subject. The intent of it is to say that in a trial, if someone invokes their privilege, and any privilege, that should not be held against them. And that would be true if they invoke an attorney-client privilege or a clergy privilege or any other kind. I guess I would describe this as almost an educational section. I don't know that it needs to be in the bill.
Senator Rudy?
The witness is too kind. I would refer to it as a badly drafted. there are constitutional problems with it, and they can be cured without making any change in it, and I would suggest that we provide, say that the claim of a privilege under the statutory citation in this, or I should put the last part of the sentence first, those two sentences, just say an inference may not be drawn from the claim of privilege under AS 2335-05 to either in a present proceeding or on a prior occasion, and that states the law on the topic with regard, and is exactly what you wish to accomplish. And the drafter,
I can understand.
And I just, in, there's a period.
I can understand not wanting to open all counseling records, but in terms of just kind of the equity of it, I don't think it's unreasonable for everybody to know that you've done that. And it sounds like this is trying to avoid even that knowledge. And I just...
This inference?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, it's not our intent to do that, and I would be perfectly happy to accept any kind of amendment that the committee sees fit. Again, it was not language that we had originally asked for. It was language that was...
So this whole the inference section was added in House Judiciary?
That's correct.
Senator Rody?
That, but the essence of that section, that no inference may be, maybe drawn from the claim of a privilege is relatively standard. By the committee, which they did, but you just stated that way. There are exceptions, and again, I'm talking to across the board in all civil criminal proceedings, and that is a question of other rules and the specific facts prior to the facts and how they handle it. It's other than just saying, restating that rule, I'm far more comfortable leaving that with the trier of fact.
Further questions? Thank you. Representative Brown, is the House still in session? Okay, you can testify now in any order that you want. We have two other people to testify. It's at your discretion whether you want to testify now or come back after they testify or however you want to deal with it. Your schedule is at this point.
I'll be brief, Mr. Chairman. Okay. I'll stay as long as I can to listen to the debate on this bill. Mr. Chairman, I think that we have set up different types of privileges to fit different circumstances, and the privilege that's been crafted for this particular group of people, I feel that it's appropriate and that it will provide them the protection that they need to be able to have the healing process go forward. And the President's Task Force on Crime that suggested this approach a decade ago was certainly put its finger on one of the problems that impedes victims from being able to work through this situation that's happened to them and move on to get their lives together. And that was the impetus for it. That group, in fact, recommended similar protection for all victims of crime. But I think in this particular group we're talking about, it's particularly important and appropriate. And I'd urge you to pass the bill as it arrived here without a major amendment. I just walked in the middle of the last discussion, and I'm not sure what exactly is being proposed on page 4, but I appreciate you taking it up, and I do feel it's important legislation.
Thank you. Any questions by members of the committee? The discussion was on the inference, and I think you probably caught enough of it. We were told that was added in the House Judiciary Committee.
The House Judiciary Committee did a lot of work on the bill, and I think the compromises that were reached there do strike a good balance.
Thank you. And we'll go to Joanne Lopez. Representative Brown, you're welcome to join us at the table if you want.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm Joanne Lopez. I'm the Executive Director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. The Council has not had an opportunity, of course, to review this language and this amendment. However, from prior discussions in Legislative committee meetings, the council legislative committee meetings, the problems that similar language could present was discussed, and I don't think at this point that the council would support this amendment. They do, however, strongly support 156 as written. I also know that network programs are adamantly opposed to it, as you just heard, and that therefore the network would not support the amendment also. It's a good bill as written, and it's a much needed bill. As a former director of a shelter, I know that. and I urge you to pass it as written. Also on her way out the door, Sherry Gall, who is up in Senate Finance, I don't think she came back in. Well, she's here, so she can speak for herself. So I strongly urge you to pass this bill as written. The minor amendments that were discussed, I don't think is a problem.
Thank you. Questions by members of the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have Dean Bonelli. Do you want to get on the list?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dean Bonelli with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I'm sure you're aware that our system of justice is based on the judiciary, a judge or a jury, a finder of fact, basing its decisions on all of the legally admissible relevant evidence that is to be brought before it. That's what our system is based on, and the more information, the better, I think, is the theory. But as Representative Brown indicated, we have, as a society, recognized that there is certain evidence for certain societal reasons that ought not to be brought in front of the judge or the jury. With illegally seized evidence, that evidence is suppressed not because it's not relevant or reliable, because oftentimes the drugs that are suppressed are the most reliable evidence, but because there is an extraneous social reason for doing that, and that is we want to deter the police from engaging in illegal searches and seizures. And to further that purpose, we suppress that evidence. In addition, we've also created a number of privileges whereby evidence contained in communications made to lawyers, to doctors, to psychotherapists, to spiritual advisors, to husbands and to wives are not allowed into court, because we want to, as a society, continue to foster and encourage those kinds of open communications. However, with respect to a number of those privileges, and they certainly are not unlimited, and with respect to a number of them, if the person puts in issue the particular matter that is related to that privilege, then the privilege disappears. If, for example, a client sues a lawyer for legal malpractice, then there is no longer a lawyer-client privilege and their communications are admissible into evidence. If a husband sues a wife or a wife sues a husband, then the husband-wife privilege is not applicable. If a person places in issue their mental condition, which has been the subject of a psychotherapist privilege, then that privilege is no longer applicable.
Let me understand this. So if you're going to say that the reason you did this was that you were totally despondent and in all kinds of mental trouble, and therefore were not responsible, once you do that, you open yourself to any and all testimony that may come from your psychologist, psychiatrist, counselor? Is that what you...
I can refer you to some specific provisions.
I guess if you use mental state as a defense, is someone who is a professional in the understanding of your mental state then still immune, or is the evidence still inadmissible?
The exception to the privilege is as to communications relevant to physical, mental, or emotional conditions of the patient. There's an exception when the condition of the patient is an element of the claim or defense of the patient, of any party claiming through or under the patient, or any person raising the patient's condition as an element of his own case. And it goes on to include a couple of other exceptions. So once that has been put in issue, particularly by the patient himself or herself, then the privileges do not apply. And Senator Adams' amendment raises the same question with respect to the victim counselor. When I was asked to review the proposed amendment that Senator Adams had, and I reviewed it with his staff, it appeared to me that it was a similar amendment as had been discussed in the House. It appeared to be somewhat broad in that it would have allowed the dissipation of this proposed privilege anytime any person raised that as an issue. In fact, if a the way that proposed amendment read when I first saw it, if a rapist had raised that issue in the person's criminal case, then all of a sudden the victim's records would be relevant and put in issue. I thought that that was too broad. I thought that that was not the intent of the legislation. And so therefore, I urged Senator Adams' staff to strike that particular exception, but that with respect to his other concerns, when a victim herself sues someone civilly, places that in issue, that there was abuse, it did not seem inappropriate for all of the relevant evidence relating to that abuse to be brought into court. That's the basis of our support of this amendment, and we certainly will respond to any questions the committee has.
Questions by members of the committee? Senator Frank.
Dean, I'm under the impression, or I understand that you supported the bill prior to this amendment, and frankly don't understand this all that well. So I guess I'm wondering just how significant this amendment is from your standpoint.
Senator Frank, I'm not sure the extent to which we categorically supported this bill without that amendment. But I believe that without that amendment, it opens the door, for example, in a criminal prosecution where a wife has shot and killed her husband, and the wife claims that she'd been abused by the husband and therefore was driven to do that, the state would be prohibited from getting evidence that might rebut that defense. I mean, I think that is a significant disadvantage that the state is being put to in that kind of case, where someone sues.
Say that again. If a wife kills a husband
and claims that she's been a victim of abuse, all of a sudden, all of the records relating to that become privileged under this proposed statute. And the state would have no way of getting at records that might rebut that. But she has put that defense in issue. And the same can be applied in civil cases where a woman sues someone for rape or abuse. That person would be disadvantaged, not being able to defend himself by getting all of the relevant records that might relate to that claim of abuse.
Well, it seems like you're kind of doing this backwards, because it seems like if somebody was raped and somebody was accused, that the prosecution would have to offer evidence that there was a rape and that this person did the raping. And the fact that that person couldn't avail themselves to records that may be at some shelter, that who knows what they would say. I mean, I suppose that a person can go into a shelter and say anything that comes to their mind, and that sort of thing. So I don't see how it would hurt somebody's. It seems like the prosecution would have to bring sufficient evidence to.
Yeah, well, I'm not as concerned in a prosecution of the rapist what is going to happen. I'm more concerned in a prosecution against a victim that the state would be prohibited from using some evidence. And let me give you an example. Two women are raped. One goes to a victim counselor with no particular training, but just someone who works as a victim counselor and says certain things. Another goes to a psychiatrist and says certain things. The one who has gone, the psychiatrist's records would be open, subject to use in court, but the victim counselor records would not be. I'm not certain that that's necessarily a logical distinction to draw. I think that the same societal interests are there. We want to encourage those kinds of communications, but do we want to elevate the status of a victim counselor above that of a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a physician? And I'm just not certain that we do, and I think that's what Senator Adams' amendment speaks to. We are essentially elevating those people to the communications to them to a higher status, really above communications to lawyers, above communications to husbands and wives, above communications to psychiatrists and physicians.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll state it again, I don't claim to understand this all that well. I don't have any experience in this area of the law at all. When you say, I don't know that you refer to it as kind of a hierarchical kind of a thing here, and I'm not sure that that's the way it should be looked at. I don't really understand what privileges the psychiatrist has and why there are limitations. And we could get into more discussion on that before I'd be fully educated on it. But I guess I'm just kind of feeling like I can see where people would want to feel that those records were confidential, I guess generally you support that, but getting into the nuances of this is where I'm having a hard time making distinctions and really understanding this.
Let me give you one, see if I can make a real concrete example. A woman shoots her husband, and she goes to a victim counselor, and she says, "Boy, am I glad I did that. I've been wanting to do that for years, and I'm really happy I did it. And not only that, but I'm gonna say that, you know, that I was a victim. I think he slapped me once a couple of years ago. I'll say I was a victim." In prosecuting her for murder, the state would be prohibited from using the evidence of that confession, in essence, against that woman. Under the version as it stands right now, Senator Adams' amendment would correct that. That's the most concrete example I can give you right now.
What? And so it would. How would it read in terms? I mean, how would that work?
How would that work? The state would charge the woman, let's say, with murder. She comes in and raises a defense that she was abused, and as a result of that abuse, she was not able to form the specific intent to kill, and whatever her legal theory is, but she claims that she is abused. The state would then would subpoena the victim counselor into court, put that person on the stand, and all of a sudden the defense lawyer stands up and says, "No, there's a privilege. I want to prohibit that person from testifying." And
well, they don't even have to do that. They can stop. I mean, the way it is now, that can be very pretty much. And even if it comes before the jury, it sounds like it's got to be explained that they can't take into account that that wasn't
sure. I mean, it doesn't even get to that point of a subpoena. I mean, the subpoena is issued, and they move to quash the subpoena. The person never comes.
The jury
forward.
Never hears any of that. They never know what happened. They never know why the attorneys never called any of the professionals, right?
That's correct, and I would like to speak about on that point in particular, after we're done with this, but that's the best example I can give.
Senator Rody.
Mr. Chief Prosecutor, would the language in the bill on page 2, lines 21 and 22, unless the court or hearing officer determines the information is necessary and relevant to the facts of the case, that deals with the disclosure of the communications. Does that provide you with any comfort in some of the situations that you've described?
I think that just talks about identifying the name, address, and location of a safe house. I think the information that is capable of being conveyed is very limited under that.
It's
which it's badly drafted and difficult to read, in my opinion, poorly drafted, excuse me. And it would make sense to, as I suggested previously, to provide that in A, that you state the nature of the exception, and then delete all the language all the way down. State the nature of the disclosure that's prohibited, and then put it on line 7, unless the court or hearing officer determines that the information is necessary or the facts of the case. Because all the language from there down is really deals with the question of consent, and then deal with a separate where D is now, make that B, and then deal with the consent, stating that the privilege can be claimed by the victim or their lawful representative, but only on behalf of the victim, and that then provide where consent can be made by the minor unless, and does that provide you with a higher level of comfort? I know that comports with the construction of the rules of civil procedure, and I'm not nearly so adept as you are in the rules of criminal procedure, so I would hesitate to comment in that area, but it seems that would accomplish the same thing the bill does, and I think what we have is a situation where the proponents of the bill are have been provided with a little poor drafting.
Senator Rohde, I'm not, I'd have to see that all drafted out. I suspect that what you're talking about is a separate inquiry, in-camera inquiry by the judge as to the relevance and necessity, that the proponents of the bill would probably not accept that either, but I don't know. I have to take a look.
It's unclear from the way it's drafted, because it can be read any one of several different, the relevancy by the trier of fact it's unclear to me the way it's drafted exactly what that's intended to relate to.
Is there any legitimate difference in the way you treat the exclusion of information in a criminal case versus how you treat it in a civil case?
Talking about a privilege, actually.
No, there really isn't. I mean, the information does not go to the jury, and the jury is not to draw any inference from the fact that there may have been evidence suppressed. I mean, there are obviously different rules as to, I mean, some evidence that would be admissible in a civil case would not be admissible in a criminal case. But if you determine that evidence is inadmissible, then the same rules apply. I mean, it just doesn't get talked about. If questions are asked, objections are sustained.
You just said there's a different standard right now in what is allowed in evidence in a criminal case and what is allowed in evidence in a civil case.
That's correct.
Is there any legitimacy in treating this particular area differently in criminal versus civil proceedings?
The general rule followed in the rules of court is that with respect to these privileges, preventing certain people from testifying, that generally the privileges are not as broad in criminal proceedings. In other words, I think there is a sense you get from reading through the rules that more evidence ought to be admitted in criminal proceedings than in civil. And then there are a number of exceptions in all these privileges.
Many of them
do not apply, exceptions apply in criminal proceedings. In other words, the privilege does not apply.
Further questions from Mr.
Gunn? Just going back to your one example, it still seems like the prosecution. No, I guess it'd be the defense would have to
show some evidence that there had been abuse, other than just to say there had been. And
but that's all it takes. I mean, by simply, you know, the woman testifying that there has been, or getting a friend to testify that, you know, she heard yelling and screaming, and slapping around, that is enough to raise the issue, and it probably is enough to allow the defense to claim that there was some sort of self-defense, or claim that this woman was abused, and the jury would be instructed something like, if you find that this person was abused, that, you know, that would be relevant to the ultimate crime that you think the person was guilty of, or whether there ought to be an acquittal. That's enough. And the prosecution then is sort of stuck. If I could make one comment about, there were some questions about the inferences, or the fact that inferences cannot be drawn from the fact that the privileges were claimed. There is currently a rule of evidence. It's Evidence Rule 512. And it says that...
Civil or criminal?
It's in the evidence rule, so it applies to both. And what it says is, a claim of privilege, whether in the present proceeding or upon a prior occasion, is not a proper subject of comment by judge or counsel. No inference may be drawn therefrom. And then it goes on. And so what it essentially does is, already in the evidence rules, there is something very much like this current provision. I have not looked at this provision carefully to determine whether it changes this court rule in any way. But one of the previous witnesses said that it probably is not necessary. I suspect that it may not be necessary. In other words, the current evidence rules already cover this subject matter. You know, it might be best to just leave it up to the evidence rules.
That whole section could probably be deleted without doing serious damage.
That's my view.
Okay, further questions for Mr. Bonelli? Did we have Gail Horetsky from the Department of Public Safety, formerly law, formerly...
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Gail Horetsky, Department of Public Safety. Did you have questions, sir?
Well, I would like your opinion, both as regards the Department of Public Safety and as regards your experience with what the reasonable exclusion should be in dealing with the counseling in this area.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, the Department of Public Safety itself has not taken a position on House Bill 156. Of course, the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault is located within the department, and they have taken a position very strongly in support of this bill. An amendment similar to one that's being considered here, but not quite, but broader, was discussed by the council. I'm a council member. I was at that meeting, and Ms. Lopez has, I believe, accurately described the feelings of the council members. It basically would have allowed the privilege to dissipate any time a rapist, you know, said she consented. Well, that would be every case, just about. I mean, so we did see it as, in that situation, the exception swallowing the rule. The reason that the department itself hasn't taken a position is that, you know, if a case comes in, a criminal case, we'll investigate it, we'll try to figure out what happened, write a report, send it on to the DA, assist as best we can in the case. But in terms of, you know, what is admissible evidence and how do privileges apply, it really doesn't affect the troopers, per se. Mr. Chairman, I used to be a prosecutor, so a lot of what Mr. Guinelli said made sense to me in the context of, if you look at it as a defendant asserting a certain mental state or a certain traumatic state or whatever, and then basically it's up to the trier of fact to decide. And I guess in those cases, it, at least in other privileges, that evidence there becomes, thereby becomes admissible because the party has placed it in issue. But, Mr. Chairman, I really think that the concern about the proposed amendment, the bad things that might happen if that amendment were adopted, I think the concern is much more in a civil context. Where you do have a victim's confidential communications to a counselor basically used against him or her, whoever it may be, in the context of a child custody dispute, for example. And Mr. Chairman, I have seen instances where, in my opinion, information was unfairly used against victims, and you know, things were raised as a pretext, and then you have a fishing expedition through the records, and there have been abuses. So I certainly understand why the network is concerned. I don't know if there's a way that things could be crafted so that there was a different standard or a different application in criminal cases versus civil, and I also don't know if the network would feel comfortable if such a compromise were drafted. I was looking, Mr. Chairman, at the present exception, page 3, and I haven't had a chance to talk to Mr. Grinnelli about this. I don't know if this is a helpful suggestion, but if on line 20 of page 3 the words against a minor were taken out, you would basically say criminal proceeding concerning criminal charges against a victim, where the victim is charged with a crime under AS 1141. 1141 is all person crime, so that wouldn't be like theft or something like that, but it would be assault or something of that nature. And you know, I must emphasize, I don't know. I mean, the network may well say that doesn't work. I wish I had a brilliant suggestion to make to you, Mr. Chairman. I do not. I understand Mr. Grinnelli's concerns, and I do understand the network's concerns, too. I think they're both talking about legitimate public policy issues and where the right balance is. I don't envy you your call on this one.
Questions?
Is Solomon available?
Thank you. Sherry Gold. Arthur, are you here to testify or listen, or is this generally
time?
Around?
I find it fascinating to go 4:30 when the finance comes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Sherry Gall. I'm representing the Alaska Women's Lobby in support of House Bill 156. When we first started talking to the network years ago about this kind of a privilege, developing this kind of privilege, it was back in the 80s, and only a few states had taken this step. In the intervening years, many states, almost half of the states, have instituted this kind of privilege for victims. And in most of those states, they don't include the kind of exceptions that are being discussed in the proposed amendment. The Women's Lobby follows the lead of the network programs in their support of this legislation because we feel that those are the people who are intimately involved every day in working with victims. And so if they feel that this amendment is unacceptable, certainly the Women's Lobby will feel that way as well. It does seem that the example used by Mr. Grinnelli of a woman having just happily murdered her husband and showing up at the shelter door and saying to the counselor in confidential communication or otherwise, well, I've just killed that guy, I feel really great about it, and I think I'll say I was beaten. I think that probably there are laws in place whereby people who work at those kinds of shelters, if a crime has been revealed to them, that they have a duty to report that kind of a crime. And so I don't see that kind of thing as actually happening. I think that, in fact, the women who come to these shelters have been raped or beaten, and that in the case of rape and beatings, there are often many other kinds of evidence that's available because very often these women require medical treatment for their injuries. If they've been raped, they've certainly been taken by the Crisis Intervention Center to the appropriate facility to collect the evidence that's needed to proceed in a rape case. So it does seem that the people who work in these clinics don't have very much relationship to psychologists. They are not trained therapists. And there are many other ways to collect that physical. And in every case, there's going to be a question of the physical and mental state of the victim, or they wouldn't have been a victim. So we support the bill. We don't support the amendment. And I think it would be, I would urge you to ask Cindy Smith to address battered women syndrome in relationship to the Department of Law's testimony. Thank you.
Questions by members of the committee? Is there anybody else that hasn't testified that wants to testify on this bill? If not, I would like to have both Dean Guinelli and Cindy Smith at the end of the table.
I think we should make Gail help us too.
I think we need to be able to both be able to respond back to what is on. Okay, go ahead with yours and then we'll.
I had two points that Dean made that I thought were not needed further clarification. The fact is that in one of his earlier examples, he said, well, if two of them were raped on the same day, and one went to a victim counselor and one went to a psychotherapist, then one would have a certain set of privileges and the other one wouldn't. This could be said of two victims who were raped on the same day, and one went to a clergy and one went to a psychotherapist. It is not, there is no exact privilege from which we are deviating. Every privilege in the state is different. The issue of battered women syndrome, I think, is particularly important because it is often misrepresented and unfortunately misunderstood by prosecution, which is perhaps why we have this difficulty right now. Battered women syndrome is a psychological diagnosis which cannot be made by our staff because we are not competent to do it. In other words, it is a point-in-time diagnosis in the same way that guilt for reason of insanity is and must be done by a qualified psychotherapist. And therefore, those records would be available for prosecution. Because our records are not investigative, we are not swearing people in, as I said earlier, at the door. Any record the shelter might or might not have would not necessarily speak to battered women's syndrome, except insofar as to say that the person either been to the shelter or not. Usually, in battered women's syndrome, these are the most abused victims. I guess that's what I find impossible to make an exception for. A victim who is legitimately a victim of battered women syndrome is one of the most abused people you will ever see in your life. It's someone who has been chronically battered to the point that they believe that their perpetrator is going to kill them. That's why they strike back. That's what the diagnosis is predicated on. That means there are going to be medical records, again, police records, lots of reasons and ways for a victim to be able to prove that defense. The victim may choose to bring these records in which case they will be available to both sides, obviously. If the victim, however, chooses to make a proof based on external evidence, which is abundant in these cases, the prosecution has a go at that as well. And so there's no lack of parity involved in that kind of decision. Now, there is also no court right that I'm aware of, and in fact, quoting the Supreme Court, the opinions of this court show the right of confrontation is a trial right. The ability to question adverse witnesses, however, does not include the power to require pretrial disclosure of any and all information that might be useful. So I guess it is a fundamental policy call. What we're saying to you is we believe that the amendment as it's drafted would have a chilling effect for victims, both in pursuit of civil claims, but even in the pursuit of our services, because we would not be able to tell them that what we've been telling them up to date, which is that if you come to us, you can tell us anything and it'll stay here. So I guess those are the points I would make.
Thank you. A question, what if you're dealing with this from a whole other perspective, and that's the perspective of another person who's been charged
You may have two potential batterers, and the person may have told someone who is responsible for the injury, and that may not be the person that's being charged. They're trying to find a criminal defense.
In many cases, in exception 7, if our services were sought, obtained or used to enable anyone to commit or to plan a crime or to escape detection after the commission of a crime, I would say it could be broadly interpreted to mean that if somebody was using our services to commit perjury, that would be included in this section. We are not intending to have our services used to enable people to perjure. I mean, that's just no part of what we're talking about here. On the other hand, it is not uncommon, again, we don't swear people in the door, it's not uncommon for people to minimize their injuries. It's not uncommon for people to, they say whatever they say. And it's not our job, we don't view it as our job to make them prove it or, you know, to make sure they get their facts right. That's what makes it so potentially damaging for these records to go into court, is it's a mistake of the nature of the work that we do. We're not there to diagnose them or to make sure that they tell the truth. We're there to help them through a crisis. But again, if they're using our services to commit a crime, there's an exception made for it.
Mr. Brown?
Well, I don't know that anything I've heard changes any of my previous testimony. But what I've heard is that that there is a desire to prevent the prosecution from getting certain evidence in certain cases. That I think the words that were used that might or might not be relevant, but the question is that it might, and is there a justifiable reason to suppress that evidence to prevent the state from getting it in the first instance, and to prevent the state possibly from using it in a trial? I don't see that there is that justification. The other thing I heard was that the statements made or the conversations might not be reliable. Who knows what they say? We don't know whether it's true. But that's not for them to decide. I mean, the fact that the statements may be given under stress, the fact that they may be unreliable, means that perhaps a jury ought to sort that out, and that it ought not to be prevented from getting to the jury because somebody believes that it's not reliable. I mean, that's the jury's job to determine that, and the judge's job to determine if it's worthy of the jury's attention in the first place. That's where we have rules of evidence. That's what they're designed to do. They're designed to ferret out what's reliable versus what's not reliable.
Did anybody on the House side just get to the point where they said Department of Law and Counsel and advocates have to get together on some kind of language that works? I mean, I don't.
The Department of Law's position on these amendments is new to us. Certainly the subject has come up before, but this is the first time that we've actually reached a particular amendments.
I don't know enough about it, but I'm concerned that you may have something where you have a totally dysfunctional, abusive family, and you can't figure out where the abuse or where the cycle starts, and there's a child that's killed, and you're trying to decide who to charge, and the information is all inside of this privilege, essentially.
Mr. Chairman, any time a child victim is involved, these records are not protected. We're mandated reporters under law. We have an exception number. Number 1 is reports. Exception number 6 is child in need of aid of proceedings. And exception number 8 is criminal charges. So there is absolutely no way that we're going to be balancing the needs of one victim from the needs of another, particularly a child victim. That's not going to happen. And the network has never wanted that to happen. That's always been something that we have said we want those records released in child abuse proceedings. So that would not occur.
Senator,
I think the gravamen of the issue is that there are two. One is in the disagreement over how the records and testimony are dealt with in criminal proceedings, period. And second, the civil actions, the potential fishing expeditions taking place. The chief prosecutor would like to have a broader latitude. Is under the rules of, to what extent does the physician psychotherapist exception apply in criminal proceedings?
I don't believe it does.
That's my recollection.
I don't believe it does.
And that's the fundamental difference from the chief prosecutor's point of view. And obviously, the network has some additional concerns, going beyond that blanket exemption. That's one. The second, and one that I'm more familiar with, is the potential for fishing expeditions in almost any kind of proceeding, civil, administrative, by motion, under almost any caption that would pull that testimony in, allow it to be used as leverage against someone who's already been abused. Has to be particularly aggravated.
Mr. Chairman, I misspoke. The physician privilege does not apply in criminal proceedings. The psychotherapist privilege does, unless the person places his mental state at issue, in which case it does not.
That is, of course, I forgot to make, that's probably a third area where the question is raised as an element of defense, as the element of claim or counterclaim, and in civil or criminal proceedings. That is a difficult knot to untie, because then you have disparate time in getting the evidence. On the other hand, you can have the potential fishing expeditions too. It's a Gordian knot, I'm afraid.
Wow. I would like to have you two get together, come back to us on Monday with something that works both ways.
What time Monday?
1:30. Okay. I can't think of any.
If they can do it, we should award medals. So.
Okay.
Whatever the witch's chair.
We don't have to do anything else.
Yes, you and I.
Okay. Let's Chair 14, no wonder they're not. Okay, let's get to have ourselves a little hearing.
Keep rolling.
Senate Joint Resolution 14. Sponsored by Senator Rohde, is the open meetings application to the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, it is a new and novel topic. Still in disgust as soon as I find my file. Mr. Chairman, the language is based on many previous considerations that we have discussed in the Senate for 4 or 6 years. And I believe it represents, from my perspective at least, the best thinking on the topic that provides a reasonable balance between the public's right to know and those occasions when strategic or personal information inappropriate for may be discussed. Obviously, deals with the question of Supreme Court decision relating to our rule of conduct.
again, Mr. Chairman, you're as familiar with this topic as I am, and you've looked over on numerous occasions the various forms of language.
Yeah, I think this is straightforward. I think co-sponsored in the past. Without looking at it, I didn't know that I wasn't a co-sponsor this time.
I would welcome the
chairman. Sessions all run together.
I would welcome the chairman's co-sponsorship.
Did you do send him off to fix it?
Yeah.
Your chairman's up to me.
We have Senate Joint Resolution number 14 before us. Do we have anybody signed up over there to testify on SJR 14? Is there anyone who wishes to testify on SJR 14? We have no one who wishes to testify on the resolution. What is the pleasure of the committee with regard to the open meetings constitutional amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I would move you now that we pass SJR 41 from the committee with individual recommendations.
14.
41. I'm sorry, 14.
Got a motion to pass out SJR 14 with individual recommendations. Unless there are any objections. Hearing none, it is passed out of committee with individual recommendations. That brings us to SJR 7. It is entirely appropriate to have limited the session retroactively to 10 days ago. You need to know if you have anybody signed up on
no.
SJR 7.
Hey, it's
Senator Frank.
$1 million savings. Well, this bill started a couple of years ago. This resolution, I had it in. It was a bill that got amended during the process to kind of a unusual construction with 45-day session and then a 10-day break and a 45-day session. The thinking behind it was that it's not a bad idea to touch base with the constituency to see what they think about things you're considering and then come back and proceed with both budget and other legislative matters. I don't feel real strongly about that provision. I think shortening the session reasonably by 20 days is reasonable. I think that we can get our work done in 100 days, even if we have a 10-day break in the middle, just as easily as we can in the time that we currently take, 121 days, and that it would just require that we start working a little harder, a little sooner, and a little bit more on schedule. And it would also, I think, help more people be able to run for the legislature. I think the shorter the session, the more interest we'll see in people in serving. And for those reasons, I think it's a good idea.
We have no one signed up to testify on Senate Joint Resolution number 7.
What is the pleasure of the chair?
I think the only question I have really is whether we should go back to just a straight 90 days or include the 45-day, 10-day break in 45 days. And I'm certainly not, like I said, I'm not fixed on either one.
I think the question is really for the sponsor what you can get the votes for.
Mm-hmm. Same old question.
Yeah, I would support it either way.
Yeah, a straight 100 is probably the most appealing.
We could certainly choose to take a break to accomplish the purposes I mentioned earlier if we wanted to, obviously. So maybe it would be better to just limit it to the 100 days and try that.
We could, on line 9, put a period after the word days at the end of that sentence. I would each regular session is limited to 100 consecutive calendar days.
I would like the period there because the existing language just says from the date it convenes, except that. And by saying from the date it convenes, in either case, is effectively gives us a 121-day limit now and would give us a 101-day limit then.
Yeah, let's be clear that we're talking about 100, not 101 days.
I would also, perhaps, to accommodate Senator Frank, strike the word consecutive. That would allow the break that, which I think is a very rational thing to do, returning to our constituencies. And if we struck the word consecutive, 100 calendar days. That is, of course, the choice of the sponsor.
Hold it now. Let's see.
Line 9.
Other states have used the lack of that word.
Yeah, I want to keep it the way it is.
Only count the days they actually have a session.
No, I want to keep it the way it is. I like it the way it is, I think. In terms of that language, myself. Mr. Chairman, I would move that we amend it to reflect 100 consecutive calendar days.
Okay.
And
then you would strike the language on lines 10, 11, and 12. And then reinsert the language on line 13 that is deleted beings, except that.
I would suggest we leave out from the date it convenes, but leave except that. So you pick up, it says limited to 100 consecutive calendar days, except that a regular session may be extended once for up to 10 consecutive calendar days. I believe that gets us a true 100-day session limit instead of a 101-day session limit.
Yeah.
I would move the amendment with the consent of the sponsor.
Okay, we have a motion to straight up 100-day session limit. Are there objections? Without objection, so ordered. That would be a Judiciary Committee substitute. Let's see, each regular session is limited to 100 consecutive calendar days, except that a regular session may be extended once for up to 10 consecutive calendar days, period. Everything else stays the same. Is that the final sponsor?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll have that drafted as a Judiciary CS to incorporate that amendment. What is the will of the committee on the...
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we pass, that we adopt the committee substitute for SJR 7, that we pass the committee substitute for SJR 7 from the committee of individual recommendations.
Okay, we have a motion to pass out SJR 7 as a committee substitute with individual recommendations. Are there objections? Without objection, so ordered. Okay, there goes that. That brings us to SB 359.
It's tougher.
This is supposed to be an easy. We're right back to your next on the list, and this should be fairly quick. Are you still meeting with finance? Okay, why don't you go on up? We'll have somebody come get you, but figure about 10 minutes.
I'll be happy to go up to Senator Hoffman and Lies.
We should be there in 10 minutes, unless there's something I don't know about this bill that Janice Adair hasn't told us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Janice Dare. I'm with the Department of Environmental Conservation. The bill before you would provide a limited immunity for the members of the general public who are on the State Emergency Response Commission, the various local emergency planning committees around the state, and the Hazardous Substance Spill Technology Review Council. This limitation would be based only for simple negligence, and the department believes that it's a very important piece of legislation, yet a sort of housekeeping measure. These entities are charged with tasks relating to hazardous substance emergency planning and preparedness, community right to know reporting for extremely hazardous substances that are in their communities, toxic substance release reporting, and the management of hazardous substances in their communities. It's critical to the success of these organizations that members of the public are involved, yet because there is a concern, and you have a very lengthy AG's opinion in your packets that outlines that concern, that they may expose themselves to liability if their plans go awry in the event of an emergency. We are experiencing some difficulty in getting members of the public to join these local emergency planning committees. So we have entered into an agreement, the Department of Law has entered into an agreement with various local emergency planning committees to indemnify or to represent the members of the public who may be sued. The state employees who are on these committees already have that immunity under state law, but it does not extend to members of the general public. This bill would do that.
Senator Rood.
Well, one quick question, Janice. The on line 11, it extends the immunity to members. However, I presume that the various groups that we're covering will have agents or employees that will carry out the instructions of the members who are there.
Senator.
Their traditional terms, master servant
right.
relationship.
I believe I understand your question. The LEPCs will not. The LEPCs themselves will, they won't have employees. Those will be the people who actually do the work. The State Emergency Response Commission, that commission does have employees, but they are employees of the Department of Environmental Conservation, so they are protected through the state. The same holds true with the Hazardous Spill Technology Review Council. It is DEC employees who act as staff to the council.
I wanted to inquire. I obviously want to do the right thing in balancing this out and make sure that we didn't inadvertently leave someone out that's necessary, because these are, of course, the people, people that take a hard look at what we're doing environmentally. And partners comfortable with it.
Through the chair, the statute that sets up these entities mandates that the department act as staff to the CERC and the Hazardous Review Technology Council. So I don't see that as going any other way. The LEPCs, frankly, aren't funded at a level that would allow them to really hire people, plus do all the other things they are supposed to be doing. They really are set up so that it is the members of the committees that do the work.
Further questions?
It's a tough area we're trying to, as it provide a delicate balance on not only on behalf of these groups, but on behalf of those people who actually clean up spills too. And
that's correct.
It's not an easy question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further questions? What's the will of the committee with regard to Senate Bill 359?
Mr. Chairman, I would move you now that we pass Senate Bill 359, unamended, from committee with individual recommendations.
We have a motion to pass Senate Bill 359, unamended, with individual recommendations. Without objection, so ordered.
See, it's already got an effective date. Oh, you can't even make an amendment for that.
Okay.
No amendments on this.
And that brings us to, this is a fatter file.
See if council changes the draft from the last screen.
Okay.
face. There's always another presentation.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, we're briefly at ease. We're going to take up Senate Bill 405 as soon as Senator Hoffman gets here. Janice, are you going to be here for Senate Bill 405?
I don't have anything to add to.
Okay. That's
okay,
what you feel.
You
read the bill, the reasons, and so forth.
It's right, it's right here.
Record. We apologize for our back and forth line.
Well, they want to need me up there too because I am the only fourth member of the committee. Everybody else is gone, I guess.
Can you testify?
No.
She was just going to start. Overview, need, where we're at.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the record. My name is Lyman Hoffman, representing the Senate District M. Senate Bill 405 is financial responsibilities for non-crude operators. The small fuel distributors, barge lines that transport refined petroleum products, and rural electric utilities that must maintain fuel storages have found it all but impossible to meet the new financial responsibility requirements imposed by HB 567. Although these non-crude operators are able to purchase the required amount of pollution insurance, underwriters in both the domestic and overseas markets refuse to include the direct action clause in these policies that Alaska law requires. Alaska's direct action requirements have been in effect since 1981. The provisions allow an action to be brought in state court directly against the insurer rather than going first to the responsible party. Ambiguities about whether insurers are limited to the face amount of the policy plus the greatly increased amount of coverage required since the Exxon Valdez spill have combined to produce the current unavailability of direct action coverage. When it became clear in early 1991 that insurers would not provide direct action coverage, I introduced legislation to delay the effective date of HB 567's financial responsibility requirements for non-crude operators. The hope was that over the year's time, either the insurance markets would overcome their objections to providing direct action, or that perhaps a risk pool would be developed to provide such coverage. My bill was unanimously approved by the legislature. Nearly 1 year later, however, there has been no change in the insurance market's position on direct coverage, and the development of the insurance pool so far has proven unfeasible. With the June 1, 1992 effective date of the financial responsibility requirements approaching and the unavailability of direct action coverage just as complete as it was in 1991, non-crude operators once again face the prospects of either operating out of compliance with Alaska's law or ceasing operations. The large crude oil operators do not face this problem because they have sufficient assets and working capital to either self-insure or comply with the law through other means such as surety bonds or letters of credit. Over the past 2 years, DEC has given additional waivers to some non-crude operators who have been unable to obtain direct action insurance but who in all other respects meet the state's financial responsibility requirements. Whether DEC has the authority to grant such waivers is highly questionable, however, and the agency recently decided to end that practice. The solution offered in Senate Bill 405 does several things. Section 1 clarifies the financial responsibility of the insurer is limited to the type of risk assumed and the amount of coverage specified in the proof of financial responsibility. It also clarifies that these limits do not apply to the applicant who self-insures. Section 2 gives new authority to DEC to prove an applicant's proof of financial responsibility if the applicant attests is a sworn statement that direct action insurance has been diligently sought but is determined to be unavailable. If such efforts are made and proven every 6 months and if all other financial requirements are met, in other words, we are not asking for a waiver of any requirements, we are just asking that the company be certified as operating legally if they make good faith efforts to comply with state laws but can't. Section 3 and 4 ratify similar exemptions made by DEC during the past year. Sections 5, 6, and 7 call for an immediate effective date if that date is later than June 1, 1992, making it retroactive to June 1, 1992, and repeals the exemption law on June 1, 1994. The letter of intent adopted by the Oil and Gas Committee directs DEC, the Division of Insurance, and the Commerce Department, and the Legislative Research Agency to research possible alternative solutions to assist non-crude operators in meeting the state's financial responsibility requirements for oil spill coverage. That concludes my remarks on the need for Senate Bill 405.
Thank you. Questions by members of the committee? Thank you. We have Ray Gillespie. If you want to join us, we're going to go to Chance there. Let's go ahead, Ray, give us your testimony. My question, of course, is going to be why do we need direct action?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ray Gillespie, for the record. I represent Crowley Maritime, Delta Western Fuel Suppliers, and Petro Marine and Harbor Enterprises. These companies represent the bulk of most refined fuel deliveries in the state, stretching from southeastern to south central and the western part of Alaska. And we would like to state for the record that we support this legislation. What Senator Hoffman has indicated to you is in fact the case, and the situation does not appear to be something that's going to change in the near future. These companies have been unable to get the direct action endorsement on any of their policies. The DEC has been issuing the waivers, because of the recent Attorney General's advice, they need to have explicit authority to continue to do that for a period of, I think the sunset is 2 years. Mr. Chairman, the Chairman has indicated a question about whether direct action is necessary. We've studied that at some length, and in the Senate Oil and Gas Committee, the work group examined that. The Attorney General's office has concluded that in some situations the direct action requirement probably has some continued, there's good public policy behind it in some situations. With respect to Alaska-based operators who have substantial assets in Alaska, we think that direct action probably is unnecessary because you have assets to attach. But because of the confusion and uncertainty at the federal level over direct action and Open 90, we think this is the best possible solution, although it's a short-term one until the insurance market settles out on the international level. This is probably the best short-term solution. We would have had representatives from these companies here to testify today, but because of the uncertainties of the committee schedule, that wasn't possible. Thank you.
Do you honestly believe that the company's insurance industry is going to provide direct action to small Alaskan companies within the next, how about this, 4 years, double?
Mr. Chairman, I would hesitate to even speculate that it will ever become possible. My companies have consistently over the last year and a half contacted their insurance brokers who have in turn talked to their underwriters and brokers in London, and they're unwilling to make any commitments under any circumstances. In fact, all they'll say is that direct action is not available. What the situation is, if you want to get in, I guess, the more technical level, it used to be possible to obtain a policy from a domestic insurance company that would cover the direct action endorsement. The direct action endorsement has never been available from Lloyd's of London. They simply refuse to do that.
For anybody in any
yes.
field, in any insurance, in anything, right?
That's the best of my knowledge. That's correct.
Okay. And maybe exceptions.
But now even the domestic insurers refuse to get involved in the direct action requirement.
and they're backing away from it in all other areas of liability as well, are they not?
Technical question for Mr. Gillespie, distinguished member of the Alaska Bar. Is the unlimited liability applicable to
everybody?
I've been saying it about you.
The rest of us won't listen because we can't possibly understand.
Is the unlimited liability provisions that are applicable to those persons who makes bills or are involved in any kind of contamination applicable to these carriers? Perhaps it's a question that's more appropriate for Ms. Dare.
Well, if I understand,
it's a question we dealt with previously in this committee at great, great length, and lost of skin in the process, mostly mine.
Mr. Chairman, if I understand the question, the unlimited liability, of course, still applies to these carriers if they're the owner of the, you know, the strict liability conditions, and the unlimited liability applies. This issue only deals with the required financial responsibility that you have to show. I don't believe it addresses in any way or impacts in any way those other provisions.
I'm curious if I presume they were or would would be bound by the strict liability.
Thank you. Do we have Janice Adair?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Janice Adair with DEC. The department does support this legislation. as Mr. Gillespie said, small non-crew carriers simply cannot meet the requirements of the law.
Can big non-crew carriers meet the requirements of the law?
Well, big is relative, no. Non-crew carriers cannot meet the requirements of the law, big or small.